You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Maureen Howard, who's published recently from Norton the book Natural History. She's the author of 5 previous novels, including Expensive Habits, Grace Abounding, Before My Time, Bridgeport Bus, and Not a Word About Nightingales, as well as the award-winning memoir Facts of Life. This book, Natural History, is a book that is set in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and in fact makes Bridgeport, like Dublin and Ulysses, the hero of the novel Natural History by Maureen Howard. I'm curious, the thing that struck me as being most intriguing about this novel is the relationship of the family, the Bray family in the foreground, to the amount of research and annals in the background. How do the foreground and the background mesh in this novel?
Well, I hope they have equal authenticity. I'm obviously concerned with that and playing with that. There is the natural history of a family story. We all still like a family story. But then, in a way, the large second section called Museum Pieces is a display of various styles, various ways. The story goes on, but nevertheless, it enters into different modes as though you are in a museum, as though you are in my little museum. And so the relationship is one of that which is natural in telling stories and in narrative, to that which seemingly is unnatural, the exposing of the facts, the exposing of the sources from which story comes. Do you see what I mean?
I'm not entirely sure. I guess, could you try it one more time? Because this was a part of the book that I found to a certain extent mystifying. I found and I understood, and let's begin by saying this is a rich and dense novel with intentions that are not always apparent. And, you know, I'm a believer that a good book should be read several times. And as a constant reader, I've only read Natural History once so far. But I saw the statement of thematics, some from Walter Benjamin about the arcade and about all of that magnificent stuff that he did in his Baudelaire project about department stores, arcades, feuilletons. I saw the relation of Joseph Cornell to the Benjamin project of putting things together fragment by fragment. But I didn't attach the massive documentation to the family whose story was being told. I didn't see their connection.
Well, the connection is my connection, and therefore, in that double entry section, the verso recto text, the narrative goes on, but the other side of the page is my notebook, is my album, and I use that definition, my album of where the imagining of this particular story comes from and how far it can go. And really what I'm doing there is lots of things, but one way to put it is asking the reader to come, turn the pages with me, enter with me into the imaginative process that brought this story about. And of course, it comes up in the book when James, the actor, has gone back to Bridgeport, Connecticut, having lived in California, has gone back to find his city again and to make a phony baloney movie out of Bridgeport. And so, in a way, what I'm doing there is saying, on the other side of the page, this guy doesn't have the vaguest idea what he's up to. Does that make it mm-hmm. clear?
Well, I thought that the subject became re-representation, that Americans, I thought the book was saying, take their pasts and falsify them by re-representing them in the form of, say, movies or sentimental stories, and that this book was an attempt to examine several different kinds of simultaneous art. That there's the there's a young girl who, nicknamed Peaches, who has arranged pictures of her lost family on the television set so that they are, for her, on TV, along with bizarre statues of her mother's Johns in a private room. And she's sort of living out the art of psychodrama and, you know, giving them their moments on television. There's Catherine, who's a spinner, and who seems to be the person who's taking craft and care and bringing it to the level of art. There's James, who seems mysteriously self turned inward. Much of his time is spent, odd for an actor, alone in a room looking at films noir, and he's reimagining his father's story. And it seemed as if the book was about some moment when truth, whatever it once might have been, bailed out, leaving people only with their different resuscitation attempts.
Yeah, that's part of it. I do believe that these people are enacting, Peaches' diorama of her family is fresh and alive and something she has invented all by herself. So that is the fresh version of an imagining. She's never seen, I make it quite clear, nobody's taken that kid to a museum mm-hmm. to look at anything under glass. But James stuck in the world of the old movies, and I use the phrase, age of the envy, we live in the age of the envy of movies. And I don't mean, I love movies, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact the love of images, and that we get lost in reimagining as opposed to the freshness of that kid's imagining, where she's thought it up herself
mm-hmm.
how she can have the comfort of a family by stuffing these creatures and making them look like her mother and those awful Johns. And I am very interested in that. The one thing, though, see if this occurred to you, Michael, I'm interested to know. The one thing is that Catherine with her weaving, her craft, James with his acting, he's second-rate actor, successful second-rate, the various people, many, many characters in the book break through from caricature to real life, to some reality. I mean, that's the salvation. There are moments in which there are transformations, and they understand that they have to go beyond the spinster, the actor, the labeled kinds of lives they're leading, and have, I guess what you were saying, is the moment of that is still alive, that is humanizing. And Catherine's craft, in the end, it's an art.
Mm-hmm.
She's able to transform strict limiting craft into art.
So then, is this why, for instance, James's wife, what is her name? Lila. Is that why she's a rodeo queen, or rather she was a rodeo queen, and she was, in her story, whored to the rodeo by a father who sent her out essentially because she was a good horsewoman, to earn money for the family, and she was the support of her family. Off to the side in a stable in this novel, her Arabian horse dies. Is that the kind of moment you're talking about, where the rodeo queen's appurtenances are removed from her and she's left with the family she's with and a kind of grief for who she was.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And she understands perfectly that being a rodeo queen was a reenactment. There you are. That's the kind of word that we were after before, in a sense, to reimagine. It was a reenactment of a phony West, reenactment of Roundup. And she understands that clearly and has left the rodeo world behind so that she can supposedly interpret where she's been as though it were, and she uses the terms of a child's story in folklore. The child, the beautiful girl, sold to give the family their fortune. And she comes to understand that, but understanding it is different than feeling it, than the live moment of feeling that she has when that horse that she loves so very much, she's loved it so much, she's neglected people, she's neglected her daughter for the love of that horse and her concern with the animals.
Now tell me, I mentioned Ulysses before, but I guess in particular because of that horse, I wondered, is there a consciously modeled mythic substratum in this novel?
There's a lot of conscious myth in the book, which is keeps bubbling up in different ways. In fact, it becomes quite obvious. People keep retelling stories about the past and referring to children's tales and to kind of primordial material and so forth. So yes, I think there is certainly, but I think that the larger myth, aside from each one told separately, Catherine's story and James and the social worker Mary Boyle, the ex-nun, each one told separately is the larger myth of metamorphosis, of a kind of the transformations devoutly to be wished if you are to become, in this case, human. You know, a wonderful book that I love is Eudora Welty's Golden Apples.
Oh, I love it,
Isn't it wonderful? And that book has, underneath it, seemingly separate stories, but no, there's chronology, you know. Definite chronology. They grow from kiddies to grown-ups.
Yeah, Guy Davenport, I think, likes to say that each of those stories is as well a separate myth of usually of Persephone or of Demeter.
That's right. He does. He has a wonderful essay on that.
Terrific essay. Yeah. She denies it.
Of course.
She smiles and denies it. But I did wonder that here. I guess in sections of the book, for instance, the section with Lila, I found the woman bedding her horse being there in the stable. I thought, gee, this feels like something that has a stronger understratum than its literal surface. I found myself feeling this is the kind of detail that comes into a novel for a reason. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, the reason I suppose thematically is at the beginning when she tells the story that James doesn't want to hear about her past, and she quotes the line from her father saying about the puppies that he brings home, she would have had them pups herself. The real thing is that her attachment to animals is so much stronger than it is to humans and to family or whatever. And really, I suppose, also it has a great deal to do with motherhood and birthing, because there are any number of lost children in the book. James Eamon, the son, James' son by the first marriage, has become somebody who's gone totally off stage. Jen is a neglected child. Peaches is a neglected child. Then how does that work out? Finally, and so the her investment in the birth of that horse is tragically more real to her than the birthing of her own children.
I see. Now I'm beginning to understand. So in other words, this novel, which is called Natural History by Maureen Howard, who's my guest today, has as its originating event a moment in which the father of the family, Jimmy, is it?
Billy Bray.
Billy Bray. He's a detective. He's investigating the shooting of a soldier by, let's say, a society floozy. Now, this story, which Catherine is fascinated by, feeling that she knows the secret of for much of the length of the book until she decides that her secret is not, in fact, the secret, and James wants to make a movie of it, this story is as far away from the story of their family and who they are. It is a story, and they are connecting themselves to a plot.
Right.
Rather than their actuality.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, now I'm beginning to see better how this book is meant to work. That there is, in other words, that people have to divorce themselves not necessarily from each other, but from the story they've told about themselves, the fictionalization of themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a sense in which they become trapped in the fictionalization or the story as they believe it to have been, and it becomes reality for them. But it isn't. It isn't reality. It isn't what really happened. There's a way in which, I suppose, the city, too, is both real. The city of Bridgeport is both real and non-real,
mm-hmm.
in that when once you enter the world of fiction, places are non-places. They are necessarily made up.
Well, in addition to the lost children, then, in the book, there were some characters who I regarded as orphans. Sister Brown, and much later in the book, the music teacher.
Yes.
Who likes watching the movie of the Music Man, although he is not himself a con man. It's as if in the movie he's seeing a story he could project himself into.
He feels he's a bit of a con man because he came with his mother from Italy to deal with music, they would have hoped, on a classy level, you know? And, of course, his salvation is going pop. He has a wonderful life as just a band leader in a high school. And so he feels, though, in that particular story that about Mr. DiMartino, he feels, finally, oh, Lord, I betrayed the high art.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's uh-huh. high. It's a kind of high-low story.
His mother's love for classical music.
Mm-hmm. I betrayed, yeah.
But I felt that Bridgeport, you know, in the way that cities generate eccentrics, recluses, hermits, and even the ridiculous people that we know who give their life to the high school choir, or and that this was another kind of childhood in adulthood, a kind of as if no man is an island, these people were archipelagos cast off the mainland and kind
right.
of left stranded there.
Left stranded there, but in a way, oddly successful American stories, finding some place for themselves, as odd as that may seem. Like the guy who stalks Billy after the murder, Lala Litwack, who is impaired, speech impaired. He ends up a big American success. Everything is kind of taken care of therapeutically, and there's a sense in which these transformations, his transformation is a happy one for him, but in the end he's told a big lie in order to get there. So it's, I am, I guess, playing with the idea of how do you get back to square one before the stories held you to such an extent that you lost track of who you really are and real connections. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can see why this is such a difficult novel to structure, because there are many different kinds of fiction and reality in it, and fictionalized reality within it. But as a result, for me as a reader, it felt like one of those very deliberate novels, a novel in which I felt privileged to know I'd be talking to the author afterwards.
Oh, gosh.
Do you know what I mean?
I guess. Well, of course. I make choices all the way along, and the circus motif, I suppose, the P.T. Barnum having been the mayor of Bridgeport for one term and being our grandest city father, is sort of the patron saint of
mm-hmm.
Bridgeport. And he really knew how to arrange his acts and how to make people attend to, indeed, three rings at once. That was his last great invention, the three-ring circus. And there is a sense in which that is a major trope, in that what I mean is by that, and yes, I did make all those choices, and yes, all those forms are there, in a way, as my kind of museum, Barnum's Museum of Natural History, and as to come to terms with the amount of entertainment, the number of shows that we seem to need in this culture.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that in this book, I you've given me a better way of putting it. I don't so much mean deliberate. I guess I mean that everything in this book needs to be understood by way of trope or by analogy. And it's a book that does not have very much of a literal surface of action. Much of what occurs when you put things into perspective, when you play one set of stories against the other, when you see the son, James, seducing a woman much as his sister believes her father to have done. The events snap into place, but not quite as a narrative event, but in the reader's mind as a result of seeing where the narratives interlock or reenact themselves.
Right, right. No, I think that is true. I mean, there is a perfectly straightforward linear story, actually. And they go from being children to being middle-aged, but there is a way in which you put the stories together. Yeah, and I think that's stories. I mean, they're not really, each story unto itself is not difficult.
Well, I found myself thinking about the book, actually. This is odd, because and, you know, this is not going to help anyone, and maybe not you either, but it reminded me a bit, the way I thought of it, reminded me of books like Joseph McElroy's The Smuggler's Bible, where there are styles of stories, styles of narrative. Smuggling in that book is the metaphor that nature and history become here. And the implicit question of what is natural in that book, what is counterfeit. Mm-hmm. And the characters are almost as if arrayed on planes or slides, having to do with where they stand in this somewhat theoretical dialectic of, you know, approaching life directly, approaching life indirectly.
Oh, I don't know. You know, my problem here is that I've always thought that I would never, and I hope I never have, written fiction out of theory.
Mm-hmm.
That the idea bothers me.
Really? Because this does seem to have so much theory in it.
If the theory is there, I just feel I'm telling stories and stories and stories of what happens to these kids when they grow up.
But these stories seem to be representative of ideas, whether it's the idea of reenactment or the idea of even the idea that you have to escape from the fiction you've surrounded yourself in into an unmediated life. It seems to me to be an idea.
Yeah, but then, well, loads of novels have ideas. I mean, without being heavily academic or theoretical. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of a novel that I like by Joanna Scott. Do you know that? About the life of Egon Schiele?
I haven't read that. I know the book, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, and there's no sense. Of course there are passages that have to do with Schiele's work, and it goes back and forth from that. But, I mean, I could name ever so many books in which I feel the story stops in order to tell us something else and then go back to the story without being instructive. But there it is, something we might like to know about history, about painting, about whatever. Flaubert's Parrot, Julian Barnes' mm-hmm. book, which I like very much.
Mm-hmm.
So really in telling my stories, I've about really the Bray family and what happened to those kids, I feel that to me any ideas were absolutely natural. They weren't reached for in any way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was what they came to mean to me.
I'm in simultaneous agreement and disagreement. It's a very funny thing. These are both my favorite kinds of books. I think they're very, you know, difficult to talk about. But I do think that when Susan Sontag comments America as history, as show, as museum, as language, you're already describing a book that's going to take most of its strides on theoretical grounds. Do you know what I mean? The book's ambitions seem exist within a realm that's not naturalistic.
Oh no, it's not naturalistic.
Oh,
that I go with. Okay. But after all, Susan said that, and it was very nice of her. But on the other hand, Susan has a mind that is so wonderfully conceptual right away. I mean, she's always ten paces ahead of me when we talk in terms of conceptualizing, while I'm sort of making up the story and hanging it with details. She's saying, yeah, but it's this. It's about this.
I've been talking to Maureen Howard about her most recent novel, Natural History, just published by Norton, and I recommend it. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.